This is a podcast edition of Dialect Radio's weekly show. We're coming to you from Bristol City Centre, just off Queen Square, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners, wherever they are in the world. Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and all over the world, including we're told South America, who access the show over the internet. We have two studio guests this week. Siamak Alimi is one of the convoy Gaza drivers and he's here in the studio to talk about his experiences. Susanna Burke was this year's Miss Bristol and we find out what she got out of it. There's features from Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and Malcolm Greaves reads another instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A.L. Street, a whimsical tale set in Wiltshire. Trevor Carter, our resident bard, reads his latest poem, and Jeff Sparks is back in the studio from his travels for his What's On Guide and the Song of the Week. I'm John Peters Coleman. First, we go over to Ed Hill, press officer for the Bristol Gaza Link, who was at Temple Mead Station last week to welcome the truck drivers back from Gaza. We also hear from one of the truck drivers who was on the convoy, Shakir Yildirim, and we also hear from Gordon Holmes from the Baptist Church in Westbury-on-Trim.
Ed Hill, talking about Bristol Gaza Link and the return of the convoy people. One of the people who's still delayed is Siva Mohammed. She's a student from Manchester University, but she's spent a year in Bristol doing an architecture student placement. And by chance, she came along to one of the Gaza meetings and heard the other people speaking, was inspired, and on the basis of that, joined the convoy group and drove a minibus. She was the sole driver and drove all the way to Gaza. I spoke to her on the phone just the other night, and at first she wasn't quite sure how to express her feelings and her experiences. And I'm sort of probing away, going, what happened? And then the floodgates opened, and it was very emotional. She said they went to an internal displacement refugee camp where the buildings were made of mud bricks. And I'm thinking, oh, I've seen news reports of that as well. I say, are these the ones that the UN built? Yes, the UN has had to rebuild using mud bricks because Israel doesn't allow the concrete or the cement materials in. And I'm going, oh, great, tell me more. And, I mean, she was in tears describing people's experience, the very difficult circumstances they're living in, the uncertainty whether those buildings will actually survive, although it's better than being in a tent. And then she talked about the people she was meeting. She went to an orphanage. She met this 14-year-old boy missing a leg. How did that happen? Well, me and my family were all asleep in our house last night. I think there was 12 in the family. The bombs fell. I was the only one who survived. You know, story after story like this of the tragedy. And sometimes we here in Bristol, we're busy getting the convoy together and we forget what it's all about. And her story's really, well, I was in tears as well, hearing the immediacy. And she came out with words like, you know, it's changed my life. I want to go back again and again. I want to help these people because I've seen how desperate it is. And the other important thing she said was, when you see it on television, it seems like it's a million miles away. You're getting the information that something bad has happened, but it doesn't touch your heart. And when you actually go there and you see it for real, you're actually there, she says, it's such a life-transformating experience. It's so real. And then you get involved. And she's 23 years old, so she's got a lifetime in front of her, and she says, you know, it's changed me for life. And I can relate to that.
Gordon Holmes. I'm a member of Westbury-on-Trim Baptist Church, aware of the community here in Bristol of many faiths, and have become part of the scene of the Bristol Gaza Link.
But can you tell us about the Baptists in Gaza?
It is a small church. It is a church where they are working primarily in a Muslim community, but they are serving people of all faiths.
And did you go to Gaza?
No, but I am particularly interested in the fact that the van that was purchased here by many people of different faiths, the contents of it came from, in the same context, in Bristol, and was handed over to this Baptist church, where they are doing supportive work for people of any faith in Gaza. It's a symbolic exercise.
That's the importance, isn't it, that it's people of any faith?
It is, yes. And I think that we Christians in Bristol need to have closer relationship with the Muslim community and do our best in a time of war and difficulty to do such peaceful things.
I'm here with Sakia, who has been talking on many times on dialect radio. Welcome back to Bristol.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what the experience meant for you personally?
Experience, it was hard, it was difficult, and it was good to deliver the goods there and back in Bristol.
So what was the difference between this trip and last year?
Last trip was difficult, but this trip, it was more people, and it was difficult again. And we had been war criminals going through Jordan and Egypt, and we had been treated like prisoners. I was just on the way back to airport, they just put us all into coaches. We weren't allowed to go to toilets, nothing to eat. Once we went to airport as well, we weren't allowed to eat. No, there wasn't anything. There was about two toilets for 500 people. And I did actually call Egyptian Red Crescent at three times. They didn't want to know. So they put the phone down on us and told us to go back to go and speak to our own embassies for food. And we had been actually starved about 24 hours while we were there prisoners. Going in, obviously, there was another problem, but... We managed to get into Gaza, and the lorry wasn't allowed in. After the fight broke out, for some reason they let us go. So the lorry was in actual Gaza in the end. So I'm proud of myself that I did that.
So did you get any apologies from the Egyptians?
Apologies. yeah, do not come back again. That was the apology.
So what did you notice this time in Gaza from last time? What's happened there in a year?
Well, I mean, we didn't have much time. Last time I spent 5 days. This time we only had about 24 hours, if not even that. But we were all tired, so we never get to see anything. But general life is just there. And obviously they're trying to get on with their lives, cleaning their streets and trying to repair with their houses with whatever material they can get.
They're not getting any outside help then?
They're not. They can't, can they? I mean, they don't even let us in. They thought we were political convoy. How can we political convoy? If we were, then I would have taken Roger Berry with me. Then it would have been a political... I don't know anything about politics. And I was just... All I care is for the people. And I was taking medicine, nothing else. And it's a shame on Egypt and shame on Jordan. So what they did, really... But thanks, Syria, thanks, Turkey and the rest of the world for who supported us.
Well, that was Ed Hill speaking at the rally to welcome back the Bristolians from the convoy who delivered humanitarian supplies to Gaza despite all the odds they came against. And in the studio we have Siamak Alimi, one of the truck drivers from Bristol. Hello.
Hello.
So, how long were you away in total?
Well, in total, I was away for about 36 days. It was originally supposed to be much less than that, about 30 days, but it extended to 36 days eventually.
Okay, and what did you drive?
I drove a van, a large, Mercedes Sprinter van, all the way to Gaza from Bristol.
So did you have a very sore bum by the time you got all the way there?
I certainly did, and saw everything else.
Yeah. I imagine you must have been pretty sick of the sight of that van, possibly, or, I don't know, some people form relationships with their cars.
Absolutely. I was very sad to leave it behind in Gaza. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. I went so much, through so much with this van that I was eventually sort of formed a bond with it.
Yeah. What exactly were you taking in a form of aid? Do you know what was in the back of your van?
Well, mostly educational material and some equipment for hospitals and health centres in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And very importantly, I took some messages of peace and some Christmas gift boxes for the Gazan children from schools in the southwest.
Okay, so how many people were in your van with you?
I was on my own most of the time. There were passengers coming on and off the van every now and then, but most of the time I was on my own driving.
So, this being a radio programme, I do have a vested interest in these things. Did you listen to a lot of radio going across on the way there, did you?
I did. I did. And it was very interesting because every border you went through, the radio programmes changed and I couldn't understand most of it, but I enjoyed just listening to people talking and listening to the new music, from different countries.
What was your favourite country's radio to listen
to,
do you think?
Difficult to say. Probably Turkey.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really interesting music.
Ah, okay, excellent. So what was it like when you had a lot of problems, especially around Egypt? Turkey helped out and Egypt didn't and were a complete nuisance. So what was your experiences of being stuck in the middle of all of that?
Well, we were expecting some problems in Egypt, and that was due to the previous experience that we had with the Egyptian authorities. Mm-hmm. When I started the journey up to Turkey, it was quite uneventful. We were driving and driving and more driving. But from Turkey onwards, you could see you could feel the difference in the attitude of people, because in Turkey, we had, in Greece actually, we had quite a large number of people coming to us, supporting us. In Turkey, that number grew, and in Syria, it grew even more. Mm-hmm. And you could see that there was a massive feeling of support and solidarity with Palestinians.
Yeah.
In Egypt, when you got a chance to talk to ordinary people, you could see that they sympathize with the plight of Gaza. Mm. But under pressure from Israel, I think Egyptian authorities' attitude is completely different, and they wanted to make life as difficult for us as possible.
Okay, so how many of you were there roughly by this stage?
Well, by this stage, there were about 500 of us,
right,
from all different nationalities, including British. They were from people from Turkey, Syria, Jordan, and Belgium, Ireland, as far as afield as Malaysia.
Okay.
So we're all sort of multinational group of people, 500 and about 170 vehicles.
So sounds like a proper sort of Babel experience. All of these languages come together. How did you all communicate with each other?
Well, mostly we were speaking English. But an interesting experience was that a lot of us felt that we should really start learning other languages as well. I mean, I was the only Farsi speaker as an Iranian. Maybe not the only one. Two or three other Farsi speakers were on the convoy. But mostly, I can say, Turkish and English, because there was a large group of Turks on the convoy.
Okay.
But our main means of language of communication was English.
Okay. So, I mean, what were the tensions that came up? I mean, that many people travelling in close proximity to each other, I mean, can't have been all plain sailing all the way, presumably.
Surprisingly enough, no, not much tension, was in evidence. I mean, there was tension between us and the authorities in various countries, not only Egypt, sometimes in other countries as well. And most of the tension which came up were really didn't last that long, because all of us were so focused on travelling and getting to Gaza.
So how did you feel, what did Egypt do, and how did that affect you personally when you finally got to Egypt? What did they try and do to stop you?
By the time we got to Egypt, we had travelled a long, long way, thousands of miles.
Yeah.
And so we were ready, really, to finish our trip and get to Gaza and achieve our goal that we set off to do. But Egyptians were quite adamant that we can't go through the route that we had intended to follow, which is from Aqaba to Nuweiba, and go up that way to Gaza. They sent us back all the way to Syria, adding hundreds of miles to our to our journey.
Yeah.
And from there, we had to put the all the vehicles onto the ferry and send them to Al Arish in Egypt and fly there. So by the time we got to Egypt, everybody was fed up with this.
Yeah, I was going to say, it must be beyond the house.
Yes, absolutely. And the last straw, really, was when they arrested four of our colleagues in the airport as soon as we got there,
mm-hmm.
which was completely unjustified. In the end, after a lot of negotiations, they were released, and they took us to the port of El Arish, and they basically imprisoned us in the port. They wouldn't let us go out, and they had the riot police outside the gates, and just building up the tension more and more. So,
do you think they were hoping that you might start a riot or something?
Well, I'm not sure, really. I couldn't judge. But from the previous experience with Egyptians, and knowing that they wanted to put us off and any future convoy, I think that was the intention. And when the riot broke out, it was a really scary, very scary moment with a lot of people on convoy who weren't expecting that, because Egyptians were handled it in a very heavy-handed way, and which was quite unnecessary.
Okay, so what sort of writing, things being thrown at the police and that kind of thing?
The situation
people
was that absolutely. The situation was that the riot police, when we arrived in the port, the riot police were already there waiting for us, which wasn't really a sort of welcoming sign, let's put it that way. As soon as we came into the port, we could see that the riot police is actually coming out of their vans and barricading the port. But what was more sinister was that behind the riot police, there were just massive big groups of thugs who were in plain clothes and carrying rocks, so you could see what they had come there for.
Yeah.
And with the slightest provocation, they just threw all the rocks at us, and the only rocks that we could throw back at them were the ones that had come over from them. So we had a lot of injuries on our side, 7 arrests as well, and quite a lot of frightened people who spent the night really not sleeping, because they thought the riot police would come in, and probably they were talk of setting all the vehicles on fire. So in that situation,
so eventually, it did culminate, and you managed to get out and make it into Gaza. What was the what did you experience of meeting people and seeing people, and did you sort of get swamped by Palestinians going, "Hey," and it was absolute chaos? That's what I sort of imagined in my mind.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, the Egyptians took so long to let the older vehicles go through out of the port that I was one of the last vehicles to leave the port. So by the time I got to Gaza, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. So the reception party, the welcome party, had come to the border and welcomed the people who had arrived there first. By the time I got there, there were still groups of people, standing by the road, giving V signs, victory signs to us. And we didn't see much of a crowd there.
Okay.
But it was obvious
you got
that
the
they
A3.
Were very, very happy, absolutely.
Excellent.
They were very happy to see us.
I'm afraid I've got to cut the cut us off there, I'm afraid, because we've run out of time. But, Siamak, thank you very much for coming in and sharing experiences. And here's to another successful convoy in the future.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Our next track is You're Beautiful by a lady named Bathsheba, and it was sung at the Bristol Acoustic Festival at St George's Brandon Hill last week.
I don't want to lose you, but I beautiful to me. We've shared some moments, some special times. I'll never forget how good you were to me. But still I wish that you were mine and I was yours, and you would just hold me every night and every day in every way. I wish that I could say this to your face, but I can't. That my feelings are changing for you, and I don't want to admit it's true. I don't want to lose you, but I just can't resist. 'Cause you are, 'cause you are so beautiful to me. You are so beautiful to me, baby, you're beautiful to me. You are so beautiful, you're beautiful, so beautiful, you're beautiful to me. And my feelings are changing for you, and I don't want to admit it's true. I don't want to lose you, but I just can't resist. 'Cause you are so beautiful to me. And my feelings are changing for you, and I don't want to admit this truth. I don't want to lose you, but I just can't resist. 'Cause you are so beautiful to me. You are so beautiful to me, baby, you're beautiful to me.
Well, that was Beth Sheba singing at the Bristol Acoustic Festival just last week. And our next guest in the theme with that is Susanna Burke, who was Miss Bristol. Hello.
Hiya.
So tell me a little bit about being Miss Bristol. How did you sort of first hear about this?
My friend won it last year, so basically she just told me about it and she said I should go for it because it's a really great experience and it looks fantastic on your CV and it's just a social thing to do. Yeah. You could be a great ambassador for your city, represent your country, if you get a free to Miss England, that is. But yeah. It's just a fantastic opportunity.
Did you get a lot of encouragement from your friends?
Yeah, definitely. Friends and family, very excited to...
So what happens then? How do you go about sort of winning Miss Bristol? What was the sort of...
Basically just went for, well, I applied online on the Miss England official website and I was offered an interview. So a lot of girls go down there and you're just picked out. I think there's about 25 you could be picked out of.
Yeah.
And then you just go for the day show and you learn all the dance routines and meet the other girls and you just get judged on not just only your looks but how you are as a person, your personality.
Okay.
You know, how smart you are. You get asked two questions, and it's just how you are, really.
So what questions did they ask you?
One of the questions was, if a friend had to describe me, what three things would they say about me? And I replied saying, reliable, trustworthy, and loyal.
Ah, sweet. So when you turned up, What were all the other ones like? I've sort of got the old-fashioned Miss World sort of picture in my mind of, row of blondes.
Yeah.
Obviously, I should point out to listeners, you're a petite brunette.
Yeah.
What were all the others like?
They vary. It wasn't your typical Barbie show. Quite a lot of the girls were very articulate, very smart, a lot of them had degrees, speak different languages, play piano, lots of variety. And also different ethnic origins as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was nice to see a different range of people.
Okay. Was there, did you feel quite sort of a bit intimidated by the... I don't know, did you see him as like the opposition, or was it all sort of quite girly and friendly?
No, it was. It was really nice. No one was horrible or anything. It was, you know, everyone was... They just wanted the best for you, you know? Just help you out and just do your best, really. Encouraging.
Yeah. So what did you know that you were going to get out of it? What was sort of advertised as being the result when you become Miss Bristol? You know, what were you expecting to happen next?
Well, I received a direct entry to go through to the semi-finals of Miss England, which was guaranteed to represent my hometown. Mm. And after I won Miss Bristol, the organiser, she was supposed to represent me as my agent, and she was supposed to get me lots of work, basically, around Bristol.
Right, what sort of work?
Well, that never really happened. I've done a few charity events, and I modelled for the National Lottery, but other than that, I haven't really done much. Okay. Quite disappointing, really.
So what sort of happens when you sort of ring her and say, what have you got? Does she just sort of say, not a lot at the moment?
Well, I've actually tried to ring her and text her, and it's like she's vanished. She hasn't really bothered at all.
Oh.
So, yeah, I am quite disappointed.
So, how do you feel about sort of, the whole Miss World and Miss England thing? I mean, some people see that sort of quite old-fashioned. How do you feel about sort of potentially being sort of objectivised in a sort of post-feminist age?
I just think each to their own. You know, I think it's quite empowering to take part in something like that. You've got to be quite confident. You know, it's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, I was really nervous. I was shaking and effing. It was probably one of the hardest things I have ever done. But I pulled through and I loved it. I've always been a performer ever since I was a little girl. I used to do live Irish dancing shows, and I just love it. Absolutely love it.
Brilliant. So what have you gone through to the next sort of semi-finals of Miss England? Is that coming up, is it?
I've actually taken part in that, and I didn't get through. But it was quite hard, because as soon as I won Miss Bristol, that competition was three or 7 days later.
Right.
And it was an eco-friendly theme, so I had to make an outfit or borrow an outfit in the space of a week, whereas other girls, they won for their home city months and months back, so they've had months to prepare, and I only had 7 days.
So who's to blame for that? Who organised the sort of the Miss Bristol thing? Is that a local council thing, is it? Or?
I'm not sure it's a council thing. I think it was their own company based organisation, and that's just what date they set it.
So you feel sort of a bit cheated by that, I guess.
Yeah, I do a bit.
So, I don't know, that sounds a little bit like it's all sort of, I don't know, is it a bit fixed or what? I mean,
I'm not sure.
I don't know, we'll not say.
I hope not. I hope not to say.
So what have you done sort of in the meantime off your own back? You know, what have you, what do you think now that your agent doesn't seem to be around? I mean, is there anyone you could complain to? Or?
No. I haven't really done anything about it. The charity events I've done has been off my own back. Mm. I've arranged them.
Yeah.
And, I'm just disappointed, really.
So what did your friend that won it last year, what happened to her?
She was quite disappointed as well. I haven't spoken to her for a long time, but someone said to me that she feels disappointed, that she didn't really see anything. I think it was from the same organisation as I had.
Yeah.
And nothing really come from it.
Hmm.
It's all supposed to change this year. There's going to be different people organising it, and instead of going straight to the semi-finals, you go straight to the grand finals for right. Miss Bristol.
Are you going to go in again?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure? We haven't decided yet.
If I was guaranteed work for after doing Miss Bristol, then I think I would. But at this rate, I don't think I would.
All right. So what positive things do you feel you've got out of it? You know, what's the best thing you've got out of it?
Meeting different people, I think. Especially on that night, it was great just meeting different types of people, what they had to say about it. And the experience of the night, really, all the preparation beforehand, dressing up, getting all makeup and hair, and just all the support from my family and friends have been fantastic.
So what next for you?
I'm not sure.
Not sure?
No.
Okay, so if somebody wants to book Miss Bristol, I've got an email address that I can give out. So presumably you're still out there looking for stuff to do.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. The email address is doesn't go sort of direct to you, but you've got sort of like an agent working in the background. And the email address I've got is anngarland2518@btinternet.com. So I'll spell it out for you. That's A-N-N-G-A-R-L-A-N-D, anngarland2518@btinternet.com. And that's the email address if they don't want to get sort of through to you, sir. How are you? Brilliant. All right, well, thank you very much for coming in, and I wish you best of luck for the future.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, the convoy has returned from Gaza, but what are the prospects for peace in 2010 for Israel and Palestine? One of the central disputes is whether the Jews and Arabs should share one democratic state or have two separate ones. Leading US Jewish intellectual and linguist Noam Chomsky, he of the amazing name, gave his view at a student peace conference last year in the United States.
If you go to the very far right in Israel, Avigdor Lieberman, who's regarded in Israel as practically a neo-Nazi, he said that he proposed that the areas of heavy Arab population concentration in Israel should be forcibly transferred into some kind of derisory Palestinian state made up of the little cantons that will be left to them. Of course, you don't ask the people, you know, if they want to go from a rich first world country to a poor third world country, which barely exists. You just do it. And that would also solve the demographic problem, as it's called. That was considered, when he proposed it, unacceptable racist position, but it's moved toward the center. It's recently been accepted by the leading figures in Kadima, the governing party, including Tzipi Livni, whose foreign minister is sort of the hope of the doves. And I suspect that that will be presented sooner or later, and it'll be presented as a land swap, you know, a forthcoming land swap in which each side gives up something. We give up the people who are marginal to the nation, and you give up the valuable lands. We're all equal. And I think that would be accepted here when it's presented, at least by the people who matter, you know, the elites. I don't know about the population. Those are the options right now. Either it will be a two-state settlement, or it'll be this. What's in fact going on before our eyes and will increase within Israel itself. Now, there is an illusion, which is pretty common these days among supporters of the Palestinians, that there's another option. The other option would be what's sometimes called a one-state solution, meaning let's just give up the idea of two states. Israel within, you know, from the Jordan to the sea, will be a single state. It'll be an apartheid state, of course. It'll have, you know, half the population won't have rights. And then you can have a civil rights struggle, and it'll be like South Africa, and you can overcome apartheid. That is a total illusion. I mean, there is not the remotest possibility that the United States or Israel or, in fact, anyone else would allow that to happen. Israel will, if that position is pushed, Israel and the United States will simply proceed with the policies they are now implementing. They're not going to take responsibility for the Palestinian population that's left scattered up in the hills somewhere or in the Gaza prison. Say, okay, fine, you guys take care of yourselves. We'll take what we want, as we're now doing, and you're free to become anything you want. Jordanians, stateless, Martians, whatever you decide to call yourself. But we'll take no responsibility. And in fact, that will simply be fulfilling a position that was proposed by 30 years ago by Moshe Dayan, who was in charge of the occupied territories. And among the Israeli leaders, probably the one most sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians, he informed his cabinet colleagues, Labor Party, the doves, that we should tell the Palestinians that we have no solution for them. They will live like dogs, and whoever wants to leave can leave, and we'll see where that goes. And that's, in fact, the policy that's being implemented step by step, and it is the policy that will be followed if the two-state settlement is not realized. Maybe as a first stage towards something else, but at least it's the only feasible thing. Well, these, as far as I can see, are the is what's likely for the range of U.S. policies, no matter who's in office. And the only way to alter this that I can see is for us to take seriously the rhetoric about democracy promotion that's proclaimed, you know, with great enthusiasm, and turn it from empty rhetoric, which it is, to reality.
U.S. author and intellectual Noam Chomsky there, giving his views on the Israel-Palestine conflict at a U.S. student peace conference last year. Malcolm Greaves reads this week's instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A.L. Street, a whimsical view of life in a Wiltshire village.
Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. The FOP. I'm feeling rather pleased with myself because I won a great victory over George the other day. He descended on us for the weekend. Some stock or other had gone up, or down, I forget which. Perhaps it was sideways. Anyway, George felt the need of a few days of rural peace in order to recuperate after his arduous labours, so he came down to cheer up his country cousins. I hope we were sufficiently grateful. Of course, George looks wrong in the country. Probably I look a trifle countrified when I'm in town, but I'm sure that I do not appear so awful to Londoners as George does to my rural neighbours. Not that George doesn't dress for the part when he visits us. That's just the trouble. He does. Very much so. He came down to breakfast in a beautiful brownie suit of plus fours, with shirt, collar, tie, stockings and shoes all blending in perfect harmony. He was a symphony in brown. I thought that when he went outside he would simply merge into our rural landscape. But he just didn't. He stood out as the one perfect thing in a world of untidiness. Nature is often beautiful, but rarely immaculate. On the Saturday afternoon we went for a walk, and early on we met a very good friend of mine, one Arnold Yates, who stopped to pass the time of day with us. There are many folk like George, who consider Arnold to be a dull, vacant and suspicious yokel. They are quite wrong. To me, Arnold is a reservoir of philosophy, wisdom and good temper. But of course, I know the key which taps his precious spring. I know how to talk to him. The subject varies with the season. All you have to do is to mention, in an inquiring and respectful manner, eggs, bees, cabbages, the correct method of sticking a pig, how to sprout seed potatoes, the easiest way to obtain the desired tilth for an onion bed, or any sensible topic like these, and Arnold simply flows with information and courtesy. On this occasion, I just remarked that the dry weather was good for the land, and Arnold gave us of his best, a rare vintage laid down some 75 years ago.
He observed that it was a beautiful day and that he supposed I should soon be busy gardening. A few more days like this and the onions were going fine. My friend was from London, was he? You do look main picked, sir, he said to George, which gave me great joy. Still, a few days down here would do my friend a power of good. Did I know that eggs were down threepence a dozen? All the farmers were busy sowing spring corn. Not that they put in much nowadays, more's the pity. Still, it was rare weather. As he went on up the lane, George inquired sarcastically if I were really interested in Arnold's conversation, or just suffering it out of politeness. "Eggs be down drippance," he quoted scathingly. "Ye gods and little fishes! Isn't the price of eggs as important as any of your stock exchange quotations?" I retorted. "Kaffirs opened weakly, but rallied a little towards the close. Do you think Arnold cares a hoot about Kaffirs?" We wrangled amicably on the way up the hill towards Groveley Wood, and stopped near the top to gaze back over the Wyly Valley. "Look at it," said George. "How the dickens you can live here beats me. The whole countryside's asleep. You might as well be dead. You're living the life of a cabbage." I gazed at the view in satisfied silence. There were many things which I could have pointed out to my companion's untutored eye, illustrating the unhurried, placid haste of this lovely Wiltshire scene. Teams of horses on the far hillside harrowing and sowing, tractors fussing up and down the fields, a flock of white hens some 2 miles away being fed in the open by a woman in a white apron. Here a herd of cows meandering slowly towards some farm buildings, and there, in a corral, an open-air herd being milked and popping out of the bale into the pasture one by one every 2 minutes with clock-like regularity. All these details, and many more, were clearly visible in the bright March sunlight. I might have inquired if he realised that his morning milk and matutinal egg in London were dependent on just such an orderly, serene scheme of things as this, of which he was privileged to get a bird's-eye view that beautiful afternoon. But knowing George, I said nothing. Nature rarely lets one down, I thought, and I prayed to any rural divinity who might be off duty that something should turn up to reveal his narrow mind to my companion. As we resumed our walk up the hill, he continued to be sarcastic about country life. "Clods you are," he said. "You worry all day about your mucky farming problems, and even when you've knocked off work, you can't talk about anything else. Now when I finish my day's work, I go home and it's forgotten. I become a new man. Look at the varied interest offered to me. I can change into evening togs and take a lady out to dinner and a show, completely oblivious to the sordid worries of my business life." "George," I said, "do you think that your questionable escapades with the fair sex are fit topics for the ears of a sober married man? Are they anything to boast about? Shouldn't they preferably be concealed, if possible? Don't be an ass, you know what I mean. Down here you can never get away from yourselves and your work. Nobody ever seems to change his clothes. You don't care what you look like." By this time we had entered Groveley, which has a satisfying charm for me at every season of the year. Blackbirds fluted deliciously. Chaffinch, thrush, and countless other songsters voiced the joy of coming greenery. A pigeon cooed somewhere in the depths. Rabbits, old and young, scuttered across the ride. Cock pheasants, secure in the knowledge that the shooting season was over, strutted proudly, and the lambs' tails were out on the hazel. But it was all as nothing to my companion. "What a place," he muttered. "Apart from the shooting, does anything ever happen here?" "People live here," I told him. "Keepers and woodmen chiefly. There's a village in the middle of the wood about 2 miles further on. Listen, there's somebody at work now. Young Bill Goodridge making hurdles, I expect. He's been at it this end of the wood most of the winter." "Good heavens," said George. "And he goes home every night to the village in the wood? What a life! Almost as primitive as the Stone Age." "Oh, shut up," I retorted. "His life's the same as yours in essentials. Hurdle making's a much more interesting job than yours, too. Forget about the ladies you take out to dinner for a while, and come and see some genuine craftsmanship. As we walked towards the sound of a billhook at work, we overtook Polly Rideout, who was dawdling along the broad ride rather aimlessly. Polly, to my mind, is one of the prettiest girls in our village. This, however, is not of the general opinion, for she has a glorious head of hair of a rich Titian red, and there is a local prejudice against hair of that colour. Polly's friends pity her for this defect, and she was called Carrots at school. I thought she looked a trifle self-conscious as we passed, and I could not help wondering what she was doing alone in the wood at 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, as it was too early for primroses. Suddenly, as we turned down a sidetrack towards the sound of the billhook, a dazzling light like a searchlight appeared before us through the hazel bushes. We halted instinctively and gazed wonderingly at this strange brilliance. What could it be? We hurried down the track towards it and presently came to the edge of a clearing. Evidently, young Bill Goodridge had just finished work for the day. With his basket in his hand, he was walking towards a bright light, which appeared to be situated in the crook of an oak, about 5 feet from the ground. He put down his basket as he reached the tree and lifted his hand to the light. It suddenly went out. It was a fragment of a looking-glass, which had been catching the slanting rays of the sun. Having adjusted it to his liking, he proceeded to the careful arrangement of his muffler, and then to part his hair with a pocket comb. "You see," I hissed to George, "what price you and your footling evening togs? You aren't in the same street. Come on. Polly'll be along in a moment. This is no place for us." And taking him firmly by the arm, I led him gently away.
And thank you to the honey tones of Malcolm Greaves as ever for his excellent reading of Hedge Trimmings. Our next song is by Bethany Porter. It's from her album Red Floor Hash 3, and this track is called These Days.
Ooh.
Bethany performed at the recent Bristol Acoustic Festival at St George's, Brandon Hill. Trevor Carter, our resident bard, the bard of Windmill Hill indeed, is back. He's here to give you his latest poem. Hello.
Hello, John.
How are you?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah? What have you got for us this week?
I've got something on the Chilcot Inquiry. You know, it's one of the ongoing
excellent
sagas of the time. So it's I was reading about Alistair Campbell and his decision to stand by his dossier, stand by the claims. And I read that he decided to stand by his claims to the dodgy dossier and this idea that we were, in fact, vulnerable to being mass destruction within 45 minutes or whatever it was. So, this is called Stand By Your Spin. Stand by your spin. Never concede your lying, never give in to prying, ignore the critics crying, and even when your story's thin, stand by your spin. Stand by your spin, whatever's said against you, don't let the lefties taint you, however history paints you, you will survive if you still grin, and stand by your spin. Stand by your spin. Those weapons were a fiction, enhanced by false prediction. Ignore the contradiction. Exaggeration's not a sin. So stand by your spin. Stand by your spin. You know every situation needs some manipulation to help a friendly nation. Say what you need so you will win, and stand by your spin. Stand by your spin, don't let the truth disturb you, don't let your conscience curb you. Let your conviction gird you, repeat the spin and don't give in, and stand by your spin. Stand by your spin, truth is just what you make it, be bold and you can fake it, hang in and don't forsake it. You've given all the crap you can, so stand by your spin.
Well, I can't think why. I've now got Stand By Your Man stuck in my head on a loop. thank you very much to Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, and may he return for many more times.
Thank you, John.
Time once again for our very own Jeff Sparks, who's here with a switchblade and a motorbike and a Sepultura T-shirt. What's going on in Bristol?
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 28th of January, Emily Autumn will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £12.50 in advance. Moving on to Friday, 29th of January, Three Daft Monkeys will be performing at DB's, which is at 49 Oxford Street in Weston-super-Mare. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance and £6 on the door. Also on 29th of January, Skank Tank will be performing at the Reckless Engineer at Temple Gate in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Red Hot Chili Pipers. This group formed in Scotland in 2004 and to date have released two studio albums and one live album. This is from the latest album, Blast Live, and it's a track that features Smoke on the Water, originally recorded by Deep Purple, Thunderstruck, originally by AC/DC, and The Fourth Floor, which was originally by Gordon Duncan.
Thank you.
That was Red Hot Chili Pipers with the track Smoke on the Water, Thunderstruck and the Fourth Floor from the album Blast Live. For more information on them, you can check out www.redhotchilipipers.co.uk. On Saturday, 30th of January, John Otway will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. Also on 30th of January, Goldfish Don't Bounce will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Sunday, 31st of January, John Pierce will be performing at the Carnation Tap, which is at 8 Scion Place in Clifton, Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's the end of this week's Dalek Radio Show. Thank you very much to our studio guests. We had Sia Makalimi, who's one of the drivers from Convoy to Gaza. We had Susanna Burke, Miss Bristol. Thank you to Malcolm Greaves, who read Hedge Trimmings by A.L. Street. As ever, much thanks to Anthea Page and Tony Gosling for all their hard work for doing the features. And the poem was by Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill. And the What's On was by Jeff Sparks. Studio engineer was Johnny Royden, assisted by Cam, and the producer was Anthea Page. That's goodbye from me, John Peters Common, and take care. You can subscribe to our RSS feed and download our podcasts from dialectradio.co.uk.